some Papier, who's a 15th century mystic who fused a bit of Hinduism, a bit of Islam, a bit of Christianity, you know, just like what I got in Manifest as a teenager. Thank you, Manifest, for everything you gave me. I had to seek the physician because of the pain this world caused me. I could not believe what happened when I got there. I found my teacher. Before I left, he said, "Up for a little homework yet?" "Okay," I replied. "Well, then, try thanking all the people who have caused you pain. They helped you come to me." To close the talky part before we go to some conversation, I just want to share thoughts that are bubbling in me, and some of them are, and one of the people I admire the most who's deeply involved in my spiritual formation here in Belfast is also in the room. It's like the weirdest, most slightly unpleasant surprise birthday party you hear. I'm sort of, you know, waiting to find out what it would be like, the line of people the end who tell me, you know, I'm not going to be on the other side of the party, but everybody's here. There's someone here I really admire, you know, I once heard talk about his life from a pulpit. He was talking about changes in his life and employment, and he said, "You know, I only get to talk to you about this because I'm employed at the sand here, and the rest of you have stories that are precisely as important as mine. You just happen to pay my salary, and so I have some kind of responsibility to share these stories with you." And I've never forgotten it. It was such a humble moment, and so I'm aware, telling you a little bit about what's going on in my life, and I hope some of it's helpful to some of you, and if it's not, don't worry, we'll go soon. I started my working life as a sociologist, and was mentored by the wonderful Professor John Brewer, and he's taught me that religion here in this society has been brutalized, just like everything else. To the point where it's often either cliche, defensive, judgmental, afraid, angry. And many of us find ourselves in a situation where it's way too easy to reduce our responses to either slagging off our ideological opponents or just stay out of the fray. The problem with the first tactic of slagging off is that, as our friend Richard Rohr is a consistent tactics critic, he says oppositional energy always recreates itself. And Brown's just commented on that. And at the same time, the best criticism of the bad is the practice of the better. Let's not just complain about it. Let's transcend it by embodying the thing that you're called to. It is difficult to bite my lip when somebody says something outrageous. I'm sorry you have to come in to this building tonight being confronted by a message that probably caused pain to someone. And if I ignore this comfort, my projection, my judgment, my guess is that people hold those messages are in more pain. It's hard to find it, but I know that it's better to say something better instead of just denouncing whatever the next dehumanizing thing that's just been said in the name of Christ. One of the reasons I think why you're the most visible spokespeople for Christianity here and often in the U.S. too, they're often the ones who are most wedded to ideological positions that many of us in this room are embarrassed by. And why, for instance, the only Christian voices heard by many LGBT people are the ones that hurt us. I think one reason is that right-wing and fundamentalist Christians tend to see themselves as having this big message for the world. They create their own community, and then they go out and tell everybody else about it. People on the more progressive end tend to already be in the world. So, you know, we join Amnesty International and Greenpeace, and we don't have so many anyway. And then when we hear someone laughing, we just say, like, "Oh, the last thing I want to do is to be in the Sunday Seeking studio with him." But I want to challenge you and say, every time there is dehumanizing voices speak unchallenged, people are wounded. And it's only going to be people in this room who provide an alternative. And the alternative is kind of just to ignore them and say something better in that direction. But you've got to be in the room. We've got to be in the room. I think the invitation that's being made to progressive Christians is to an ethic and posture of hospitality. Now, colloquially, we think of hospitality as when you have someone over dinner where they stay the night. And that's cool. But here's a definition I like. This is from someone called Louis Chevalier de Joncourt. I guess it was probably from Paris. He describes hospitality in his encyclopedia, which I think is an encyclopedia, as the virtue of a great soul that cares for the whole universe through the ties of humanity. It's a bit of an elevation of Jamie's quick recipe. Cares for the whole universe through the ties of humanity. My husband, the Reverend Dr. Brian Ammons, who grew up Methodist, which is something, I mean, both our maternal grandmothers are the ancestors now, and we've often thought that, you know, they were both Methodists and Methodists, that if we were to they were alive and we were telling them about our relationship, we'd start with, no, the good news and bad news. The good news is that married and Methodist. The Reverend Dr. Brian Holmes, who's actually a Baptist pastor, said, hospitality is holding space for the other to be more fully themselves. And that, of course, works on us too. Comes back to you. I say hospitality is healing ourselves through opening to the world. Not close. Opening to the world. And this hospitality is not just for the other, although it's unthinkable about it. You can't do this in a gallery. It's also hospitality toward new ideas, toward our own shadows, the stuff we're embarrassed by or scared to talk about. And toward the notion of God, if God is to be worthy of the name, God is always bigger than the best ideas we could possibly have about God. If this ethic, which to build on what my old friend Pete Rollins would say, if this ethic is about how we believe as much as what we believe, if this ethic can become central, then the traditions of Christianity that already exist can be renewed in a way that can only heal. I think there's four pillars of authentic religious practice that I want to participate in. One is to lament our sorrow and celebrate our joys, and to do that in community. Two is to educate for the realities of the world, not overstating how bad things are. Violence is actually reducing around the world, and it's reducing because people don't tolerate it anymore, and then the community can rise up against it. So educate for the realities of the world, and in its hopes as well as its challenges. The third thing is to make community together in a way that marks the important moments in our lives. Our births, our marriages, our divorces, our deaths, when we need support. And the fourth thing is to inspire change in the world. The great thing is these traditions already exist. And what I feel called to, in closing, is three things. I feel called to participate in rituals that create a sense of the sacred and support human struggle and celebrate achievement. Perhaps the most vital place for the church to do this today in this society is in regards to dealing with the past. We hear about it all the time, to the point where many of us just switch off and we don't even know how we begin to do that. The church has a profound and vital, unique role in this. I get feedback a lot in the US. Feedback's a generous term. It's you use too many words to say too little. I think there's a Northern Irish cultural trope where we love our voices, and we have great voices, and we're very poetic. But there's this thing we do, particularly in the video, where we talk about talking about things. How many times have you heard someone say, it's really important that we have a conversation about this, or this is a vital conversation to have, and then they never have a conversation? let's take like the first talking about and stop talking about it, but actually talk about it. How about we just have the conversation? People want to follow Jesus, we could probably usefully begin by doing a fearless moral inventory of our own institutions' contributions to the conflict in our community, and by assisting people who suffer, and we are in this room, people who suffer. We're here. People who suffer in the troubles to name out loud what our specific needs are, and to help us meet those needs, whether or not state agencies step in or politicians are going to get their act together. That sucks, scapegoating politicians. It's really hard to do in America, I have to acknowledge. The second of the three things I have to call to celebrate community and find wounds and celebrate joy together. Once a week, we eat together at a gathering in my adopted hometown in North Carolina, and we finish the communion by saying, "You are a beloved child of God, no matter what." We recognize that we're part of something larger every time we eat the bread and drink the wine. Sometimes I'm thinking about the larger family of humanity. Sometimes I'm just looking across the room thinking about my local chosen family. Whatever I'm thinking about, the traditions of Christianity connect me to myself. And they're there for me when I'm in trouble. They help me celebrate when something lovely happens. And they will bury me when I'm dead. Community does not require ordination or special robes, and certainly not a special building. I think a new vision of converted Christianity will recognize that there is as much sacredness in a pint around the corner or a meeting with friends as there is in a cathedral. And lastly, religion, which is not politics and is not the media, but has a public role, is called to what Scripture names as prophetic witness. And that requires discernment, but we have a responsibility to educate ourselves about the needs of the world and seek wisdom in the community about how we may serve. We will not figure it out alone, we don't have to. And our activism will usually be best done in partnership or support with others, especially when we're serving among marginalized people. The voices of marginalized people need to lead the movements to overcome the oppression of marginalized people. And if they're so marginalized that they can't speak, we need to support them in hearing their voices first, not assuming we know what it is they want to say. Two current and obvious examples. The impact of welfare reform is a gospel issue. You can say it if you feel like it. And the people suffering from it need to be heard just as much or even more so than the public leaders speaking their mind. And let me propose that the LGBT community doesn't just need to be supported, affirmed, and sometimes defended as a majority community, but that we, who are members of the LGBT community, may actually have gifts to share with everyone. Gifts about courage, about friendship, about becoming comfortable with complexity and paradox, which itself might be the most important thing any of us can do if we want to be healing agents in the world. Prophetic witness to the restoration of all things can't happen if we just keep our heads down. There's pain caused every time one of our fundamentalist brothers or sisters appears on the media, every single time. All they're doing is repeating the unquestioned beliefs about other people that they were raised with. And often all I'm doing is complaining about that. Prophetic witness doesn't just happen on the radio, of course, but true vocation doesn't need to ask permission from its opponents. Mm-hmm. Another gift of LGBT experience may be the imperation to live out love. Loving God, loving neighbor, loving yourself, doing unto others as you would have them do unto you, and doing it in public is an invitation to hospitality that will contribute to the restoration of all things, and it's the most amazing river to swim in. Hospitality. Thanks for your hospitality and inviting us here today.